Good morning, everyone. My name is Dr. Gary Erbstoser. I'm currently the president of the Arizona Board of Osteopathic Examiners in Medicine and Surgery. I would like to call the meeting to order on Saturday, August 13, 2022, at approximately 8:35 a.m. Mr. Bohol, can we have roll call and review of the agenda?
Yes, sir. Dr. Oda.
I'm here.
Dr. Walker?
Here.
Mr. Berg?
Present.
Mr. Goodman?
Present.
Dr. Chiffon?
Present.
Dr. Matem?
Present.
Dr. Erbstoser?
Present.
You have a quorum?
The mission of the board is to protect the public by setting educational and training standards for licensure and by reviewing complaints made against osteopathic physicians, interns, and residents to ensure that their conduct meets the standards of the profession as defined by law ARS 32-184. I'd like to call to the public and welcome the students from Midwestern University College of Osteopathic Medicine, A.T. Still University of Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine, and A.T. Still University School of Osteopathic Medicine in Arizona. Thank you for coming. I think you'll enjoy the meeting. If any member of the board who is not a respondent or licensure or applicant or a complainant wishes to address the board on a matter that does not appear on the agenda, you will be asked to speak during the call to the public. If you want to address an issue that's not on the agenda, you will also be asked to speak during the call to the public. All those wishing to speak should contact a member of board staff at this time. Do we have anybody, Mr. Bohol?
We have no one signed in to speak at this point.
All right, moving on to item four, review and consideration and approval of minutes for a March 26th of 2022 executive session. There was a, I think Dr. Matem had a issue with some language or something on the last,
which is a clerical issue, Mr. President. I make a motion to approve at this time.
Do I have a second? Me. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
4B, June 11th of 2022, open session. We've all had a chance to review it. Are there any questions or concerns?
Motion to approve June 11th, open session.
Second.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
4C, June 11th, 2020, executive session. Any concerns or questions?
Motion to approve June 11 executive session.
Yep. Second by?
Second.
Second.
Oh, I second.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? None. Okay, we don't have any case reviews, so we're going to move right on to our investigative hearings. Item 6A, DO-21-005A, Dr. Alexander Lund. Is Dr. Lund here?
I am here, yes.
Oh, there you are. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well, thank you.
And this is Artie. I'm his counsel.
Yeah, we're going to get there. Let me just click this off here so I can see you. Can you introduce your counsel, please?
I can introduce myself. My name is Artie Eves. I'm here for Dr. Lund.
Thank you very much. Let's swear in the doctor, please.
Can you please raise your right hand? Do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Is the complaint in here? So be it. Can we have a brief summary?
Yes. The complainant in this case was the patient CE. Dr. Lund saw patient CE in September 8th, 2020 for nosebleeds and right-sided periorbital pain. He ordered a CT scan, which was performed on September 30th. The radiologist called Dr. Lund and reported that there was an abnormal result of a cranial mass thought to be a meningioma. Dr. Lund, according to his ward response, decided not to call the patient that day, but instead wait to inform him at his next scheduled visit. At the time of the next scheduled visit on October 13th, 2020, Dr. Lund reviewed parts of the CT scan with the patient that had to do with his sinuses, but failed to review or mention the finding of the meningioma. The patient went on to have a grand mal seizure on October 20th, 2020, and further workup revealed the brain tumor. Our expert that reviewed this case felt that Dr. Lund may have fallen below the standard of care. He felt that Dr. Lund had two opportunities to inform the patient of the abnormal finding on the CT scan, but failed to do so.
Dr. Lund.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, board members. My name is Alexander Lund. I am a practicing general otolaryngologist in Flagstaff, Arizona. Including my training, I've been in practice for over 10 years now, with four of those years being in Flagstaff. I am board certified through the American Board of Osteopathic Examiners in otolaryngology. And I am currently working on a fellowship in otolaryngic allergy through the American Association of Otolaryngic Allergy. I am a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and serve as department chair over ENT, plastic surgery, and ophthalmology through Northern Arizona Healthcare. I work in an extremely busy multi-specialty group here in town, and I do pride myself in playing an important role in our small community. And I plan on practicing here for many more years to come. In the course of my career, I've never been subject to a complaint of this magnitude, and I've never had to address the board in this capacity. I do want to start by letting this board know that I appreciate your time and attention to this concern, and I do appreciate the value of the work that you do. This has been a very difficult failure on my part to wrap my head around. The remorse has been overwhelming. I've lost countless hours of sleep over this. Upon hearing of the patient's seizures, I've had thoughts of, why did I let this happen? To what can I do to ever let this happen, from happening again? Occupy my thoughts since I did hear of the outcome. I absolutely appreciate the gravity of my mistake, and I would like to briefly discuss how this came to happen and how I can say with certainty that this will never repeat itself. I first saw the patient CE on September 8th, 2020, for chronic nosebleeds and retroorbital and periorbital pain on the right side that subsided with alcohol use. I decided to order a CT scan to better evaluate the sinuses, as periorbital pain can be a sign of chronic sinusitis. The scan was actually completed on September 30th. I received a phone call the evening of October 1st from the radiologist informing me of an incidental finding of a right-sided temporal brain mass. I did acknowledge the findings, and knowing that I had a follow-up appointment with the patient, as well as knowing that the patient was relatively asymptomatic and that this was not an extremely urgent matter, I thought it best to convey this information to the patient face-to-face. At the time, it was my expectation that I would naturally recall the findings and be able to convey that information at the follow-up appointment. Alternatively, my review of images with the patient, I thought that would jog my memory. I appreciate now that it was a mistake on my part not to note in the chart, so as to ensure that I would convey that information at the follow-up appointment. On October 13th, that was the follow-up appointment with the patient. I did review the images with him, and at the time, my focus was on the sinuses, as that is my specialty. I regularly interpret sinus imaging on my own rather than completely relying on the radiologist's impressions, as I am more apt to appreciate findings relevant to my care and treatment focus. So when reviewing the CT scan with the patient, I didn't review the impression, and my review of the images did not jog my memory, as I only went so far into the images as necessary to review the sinuses, thereby necessarily omitting the brain mass at issue. In short, the medical consultant was correct in that I had two opportunities to convey this information to the patient, and I unfortunately failed to do so. I would like to take this time to publicly apologize to the patient CE. It was my responsibility to convey this information to him, and I failed to do so. When I learned of CE's seizure, I reached out to him and I spoke to his wife, to whom I apologized. I was never able to get a hold of the patient directly. I have addressed this at length in my response. I wish I could go back and make this right. I appreciate that this failure was a result of a shortcoming of my system of communication of incidental findings. While I make no excuses of my failure, I do believe that this occurrence does represent an isolated incident and is not reflective of my standard of practice as a whole. Furthermore, I have taken the following proactive steps to ensure that this conduct never repeats itself. I have taken over 6 hours of CME courses on EHR systems and proper documentation. I have submitted certificates to the board through my attorney. Through my participation in these courses, I've been able to utilize reminder functions within my practice's EHR system that I didn't know existed until then, that allows me to remind myself of important information that needs to be conveyed to patients at follow-up visits. Finally, going through this process has been extremely humbling. I was professionally mortified when I learned of my failure to report this finding at the time of the occurrence. And the discomfort that realization caused me since has forced me to completely reevaluate and readjust my process for communicating incidental findings, such as going through the images completely with the patient, reviewing radiologist impressions as well as my own. As anecdotal evidence of improvement of my symptoms, since this incident has occurred, there have been at least 4 separate instances in which incidental findings have been communicated to me by a radiologist, in which I have been able to promptly convey that information to the patients and facilitate proper care to the proper specialists. As mentioned before, I am extremely upset with myself about this. I'm ashamed, I'm embarrassed, and I am sorry that this had the outcome that it did. I do appreciate that it is within the board's discretion to potentially issue a disciplinary outcome, I do respectfully request that the board allow me to avoid these consequences, given the isolated and unique nature of this circumstance. I understand that disciplinary action could have consequences such as publication of my wrongdoing on the board's website, as well as potential failure termination of insurance panels, which could greatly impact the care that I give in our small community. For this reason, I respectfully request of the board that they impose a non-disciplinary action, such as a letter of concern rather than a decree of censure, as I can say with the utmost sincerity that I have learned a great deal from this experience, and that it has caused me to make changes, permanent changes, in my practice to ensure that this outcome will never happen again. I appreciate your time.
Hughes, would you like to comment now, or can I open it to the board for questions?
You know, normally I do have some follow-up questions, but I think Dr. Lund did such a good job, I don't have anything to say.
Board members, questions, concerns?
May I, Mr. President?
Yes, Dr. Maiden.
And I'm sorry, Dr. Lund, I know the dates, but I didn't look back on the calendar to see if that was over weekend. Was that over a weekend, the time frame from the follow-up, from the call from the radiologist?
The call from the radiologist was, I believe, I don't believe it was a weekend, no.
And do you work full-time in Flagstaff, or do you have offices elsewhere?
Full-time in Flagstaff.
And so you have a five-day week?
Correct.
Do you have a time frame where you think you could have gotten that patient in earlier?
I probably could have, yes.
I know that can be difficult, and I certainly do not disagree with having some conversations in person. I'd be very tempted to have that conversation in person with somebody instead of over the phone. And I certainly understand the thought that you would remember it. I would think I would remember it, but I know I do have to jog my memories sometimes. And I really appreciate your response to the board. That was very informative. Perhaps you don't have to make recommendations as far as what we do, but the rest of it was quite eloquent and helpful. I appreciate it. That's all I have for questions. I'd like to give the other members a chance to ask questions. Dr. Estrada?
Sure. If you want me to add that I think September 30th was a Thursday, and then he got the call October 1st, which was a Friday.
Thank you. That's perfect. I appreciate it. If there are no other questions from the board, I'd like to make a motion for a non-disciplinary letter of concern for failure to notify a patient and seek appropriate consultation for an abnormal finding on a CT scan of the sinuses with a finding of a meningioma.
Motion on the floor. Second, Dr. Oda. Okay, we need to take a roll call vote.
Okay. Dr. Oda?
Yes.
Dr. Walker?
Yes.
Mr. Berg?
Yes.
Mr. Goodman?
Aye.
Dr. Chabon?
Yes.
Dr. Maiden?
Aye.
Dr. Herbstoser?
Motion passes. Thank you, Dr. Lund, for showing up. It was, like Dr. Maiden said, elegant. It was very well said. I know you feel terrible about this, and I hopefully will never see you back here again.
I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. East.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Very good. All right. We're now moving on to 6B. Dr. DO-220002A, Dr. Christopher Speakerman.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Good.
Yes.
Mr. President?
Yes.
Dr. Speakerman is my son's pediatrician, and I communicate with him on a pretty regular basis. I'll leave it to your discretion whether you think I should recuse myself, but we do communicate very regularly.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Berg, whether you recuse is an individual decision.
Okay. I'll go ahead and recuse myself. I just don't want any decision I may put forth here to be viewed in a different light. So I'll just
Mr. Berg away. Recuses himself. Dr. Chapon?
I'll need to recuse myself as well.
Okay, so we'll exit you guys out. Okay. Dr. Speakerman, can you introduce your counsel, please?
Sure, it's Claudia Stedman.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. Okay. Can we swear in Dr. Speakerman?
Please raise your right hand. Do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Is the complainant here?
I do not believe the complainant is present. We did contact her, and she was going to try to be available, but I do not believe she's in attendance.
Can I have a summary of the case, please? Oh, wait, first, Dr. Speakman, just give a really brief summary about yourself. And
yes, Chairman, thank you. Good morning to you all. My name is Christopher Speakerman. I've been practicing medicine here in the Valley for 22 years. I graduated from Western University of Health Sciences in California in 1998. I was a head clinic coordinator there. I did my residency at the University of Florida in Jacksonville. During my residency program, I won the Pediatric ER Resident of the Year. I'm board certified by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the National Board of Osteopathic Medical Examiners. I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics and has served at the Division of the Children's Post-Infectious Autoimmune Clinic Center of Excellence at Banner Children's Desert from 2018 to 2021. During this time, I also served as adjunct clinical professor at the University of Arizona Steele Center Division. I'm currently, adjunct clinical associate professor of pediatrics and regional dean of medical education at A.T. Still Kirksville College of Medicine in Mesa. Let's see. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Speakman.
I work in Desert Valley Pediatrics, so that's a primary what I do.
Thank you. Can we have a summary of the case, please?
Yes. This case was reviewed by a board-certified pediatrician. The complainant is the mother of patient UK. The complainant states that she took her 8-year-old daughter to Dr. Speakerman for a second opinion regarding the diagnosis of PANDAS, which is pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with streptococcal infections. She states in December of 2021, her daughter began to have body dysmorphia, anxiety, and OCD behaviors marked by excessive exercise. She states her primary care physician performed streptococcal blood tests, which were negative. The complainant states Dr. Speakerman performed a cursory examination and then asked to speak to her and her partner alone. She states he informed them that their daughter had a diagnosis of PANDA, and due to an undiagnosed staph infection in the sinuses. She alleges Dr. Speakerman stated there was no need for a blood test because it could not be picked up and that the infection had crossed the blood-brain barrier and was causing her these symptoms. She states he recommended antibiotics, ibuprofen, and steroids, and if this was unsuccessful, then they would start her on IVIG and possibly Lexapro or Prozac. The complainant alleges when she stated she was reluctant to use steroids, Dr. Speakerman became defensive and snapped at her, stating he was an expert in the field. She alleges he also told her she suffered from an undiagnosed OCD, ADHD, or generalized anxiety disorder and should seek treatment herself. The patient was seen, 8-year-old female was seen in the ED on December 21st, 2021. At St. Joseph's Hospital, that she had a follow-up visit with her pediatrician the next day on December 22nd, 2021. The patient had the complaint of sore throat for just one day and one episode of vomiting. The mother complained that the patient was anxious, stressed, was having intrusive thoughts, tightness in her chest, voices in her head saying she was fat, and she was fixated on her weight. She was a competitive gymnast, and she seemed to have an obsession with exercise. The patient's mother was there, and they were wondering about whether or not she had PANDAS. In the ED at St. Joe's, they performed blood work, a urine, and a CT scan of the head, which was all normal. They also did a strep screen, which was negative. Mm-hmm. The patient had had a COVID test or a COVID positive a month earlier in November 15th, 2021. The primary care pediatrician advised that they follow up with a psychologist or a psychiatrist and prescribed a low dose hydroxyzine in case the anxiety came back for her to use as needed. He also ordered, or she also ordered, an anti-streptolysin O, which returned, the result returned is less than 20, and normal would be less than or equal to 149. The other history on the patient is that she had also been seen by her primary care in September of 2021 with congestion and fever for a week and a fever of 102. They also was seen in the emergency room the day before. They had tested her for COVID, flu, and strep, which were all negative. They did treat her with Augmentin at that time. Then our expert looked at this case, and she felt that Dr. Speakerman may have fallen below the standard of care in that she felt his diagnosis of PANDAS in the patient was based on incomplete diagnostic criteria and his treatment was inappropriate. She states he used the presumed staph sinus infection as part of his diagnosis. She notes the causative bacteria for PANDAS is strep, not staph. She states he also gave erroneous information regarding the fact that a blood test won't pick it up. As she notes, a positive throat culture or rapid antigen test for strep group A and a positive culture from infected skin or a significant rise in anti-streptococcal antibodies between the onset of symptoms and 4 to 6 weeks later can be used. Dr. Adams states that Dr. Speakerman prescribed Augmentin, which she noted is not the recommended antibiotic used for the treatment of PANDAS, and it does, as it does not provide intracellular penetration. She states a SUP was foreign, azithromycin or clindamycin are the preferred agents for treatment. She states neuropsychiatric therapy is also advised. She also noted he recommended oral steroids, which she states are not considered standard of care. She states immune modulating therapies like oral steroids and IVIG remain controversial. Our expert noted that the hypothesized association between PANDAS and group A strep is controversial. She states PANDAS is a clinical diagnosis and may be suspected in children with an abrupt onset of neuropsychiatric symptoms, a recent group A strep infection, and remission of the neuropsychiatric symptoms with antibiotic therapy. Thank you.
Well done, Dr. Prah. Before we get started, Dr. Speakerman, just for the benefit of the medical student, can you just briefly talk about what PANDA is so they get an idea of what it is?
Sure. So PANDAS is essentially rheumatic fever of the brain. Okay. You have an initial strep infection. We're just talking about PANDAS here for a second. And that's the one the most the lay public knows and people would understand. So I used that term in the beginning in order to kind of get people to understand what we're talking about. So what happens is we get a strep infection, typically in the throat. It can be in the sinuses. I've seen it on the skin. And there is some, again, going back to Dr. Adams' point, there's some controversial evidence that you could actually have it in the colon. Anyway, once you have that infection, instead of making antibodies appropriately against the strep organism, you actually make autoantibodies that are going against the basal ganglion of the brain. And the basal ganglion is an area that is responsible for our emotions. And so when we start making those antibodies, it goes across the blood-brain barrier. There has to be inflammation there. And it attaches to either a couple dopamine receptors, which codes for essentially acute acute OCD, anxiety, and enuresis. And there's a couple other, and CAM kinase is the other one. Then the second two that are more dangerous are ones that actually go against the cells of the brain itself. And those are the PANDAS that you've got to get really quickly because they're extremely dangerous. So there's five antibodies that we look at. Once it becomes chronic, so after that initial strep insult, there is something called memory B cells that all the medical students are familiar with. Our memory B cells are responsible for when we get challenged by influenza that we've seen before, COVID that we've seen before. Those memory B cells now start to make those antibodies again. The problem of it is if they're making autoantibodies against the brain, you no longer need a strep organism to cause that process. The reason I use PANDAS in general is because people have heard it before. That's why we use the term, and where I worked was the CPAE clinic. That term was formed by Dr. Michael Danes, which is children's post-infectious autoimmune encephalopathy. Because as this process happens, once you get the memory B cells, other things can trigger that reactivation of the B cell itself. And so what happens is these children get the first two major criteria is acute OCD. So I always say, do you have a surfer boy? And the next day he wakes up and he's a complete egghead, won't touch anything, won't do anything, won't you know, put his feet on the ground because he's worried about contamination. Or a child that his favorite meal is waffles. And he wakes up the next morning and he looks at the waffles and says, I can't eat that, I'm going to choke. And then we have minor criteria. And all of these criteria are, interestingly enough, housed in the basal ganglion, so we can take it back to that spot. And nocturnal enuresis, tics, sleep disturbance, agitation, to name a few. And it is a completely clinical diagnosis. We have been searching for the quote-unquote magic bullet with lab work forever. I do appreciate that Dr. Adams is correct in saying that most people will form those antibodies, those ASOs and the anti-strep. However, when the immune system is not working, like in this case, I believed it to be, they may not make those antibodies. They may not make them ever. And so that is, you have to unfortunately do a complete clinical diagnosis, which I had set forth also in my secondary response to the board, how the Steele Center looks to diagnosis. And if the medical students want to know, a quick way to diagnose pandas is to look on the Steele Center's website, and it gives you the whole host of how this happens.
Very good. Thank you. All right. I'm going to open it first. Ms. Deadman, would you like to comment? Or would you...
Sorry, that's my... Could you get the dog, please? Thank you. Sorry about that, guys. My son just walked in.
If it's all right with you, Chairman Archschauer, I will reserve any comments at the end.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to open up some of the questions to the board members. I'm sure there's lots of them.
I'm sorry, Dr. Erbstrasser. Dr. Speakerman gave us information about pandas, but not about this case in particular.
Sure. Right. That's what I wanted, though. I wanted the medical students to know.
Yeah, did Dr. Speakerman have information he wanted to tell us about this patient interaction in particular?
Sure.
More he wanted to tell us what was going on. If that's okay with you, Dr. Erbstrasser.
Oh, no, please. No, I'd love to.
No, I wanted him to define panda so the medical students know so they're not out and they don't know what this is all about. Now, as Dr. Madam said, you can comment on the case.
Sure. So this is an 8-year-old female that came in with essentially, if you look at the medical record, met both of the major criteria, of the minor criteria. So my concern was this kid was at BASIS, was doing, you know, Olympic gymnastics, was, I mean, visibly kind of tired when I saw her on exam. And she had an acute history of essentially a psychiatric deterioration. So as we all know I won't say this for the physicians, but for the people otherwise, is you always look at what is the worst diagnosis first. So abdominal pain, for example. You have a kid that comes in with a high fever, vomiting, and generalized abdominal pain, and it hasn't localized to the appendix yet. You still think about appendicitis. So in this case, the worst diagnosis for this kid could be, by far, is pandas or pans. If this was that secondary time, it's tough to delineate because sometimes you won't find where the strep is. A lot of times, and if you look at Dr. Bozell's report, that I gave you in the supplemental is you can have staph or strep, or actually be strep in this case, in the sinuses that we can't actually find or test for, but it's there. So you assume that that's a place that it could be. So in this child's case, with the presentation, she met all the clinical criteria, and they have to meet clinical criteria because that's defined by the Steele Center. They're not my criteria. They are built from the Centers of Excellence. I looked at those, and she was a slam dunk as it pertains to wanting to treat this child. This disease process can be as significant as serious as cancer, especially in the last two autoantibodies that I discussed. That actually destroys brain tissue in the basal ganglion. So you have a short window in when to stop this. And so this kid came in, and these symptoms kind of started in September but continued. But then I saw that acute breakdown, as Dr. Prad indicated, kind of at the emergency department. And unfortunately, in the emergency departments, we get a lot of these kids, and they get misidentified as an acute psychiatric breakdown. This child with the pressure she was under certainly had the ability to have the psychiatric aspect of the breakdown. The good news about psychiatric breakdowns is they're a lot easier to treat than is pandas or PANS. And so you have a very short window in order, we discussed a little earlier with pandas, that memory B cell. Once that memory B cell goes into memory and dormancy, any infection, increased inflammation from staph, I've seen it happen with nasal flu. Kid got nasal flu and it reactivated their PANS and pandas. So any inflammation causes those problems. So I really wanted to get ahead of this with this child. So I recommended, and I sat down with the mother, literally in the middle of COVID when we are having all that, the Delta. And the mother, when it was actually the stepmother of the child, had called in, and my staff had actually said, I don't see pandas anymore. And she actually said something to the extent, well, we just want a second opinion. So she was scheduled for either a 15 or a 30 minute office visit. And I sat there because I was so frightened for this child and spent 45 minutes trying to explain that we need to get this under control as quickly as possible. The Augmentin is chosen not because it kills strep better, but Augmentin is chosen in case there is like a moat around a castle. So Moraxilla is in chains, and it does a really good job at kind of protecting that strep organism. Plus, this child had Augmentin, as previously mentioned, and had done quite well on it. So I typically go with a little heavier antibiotic, and to say, actually, Dr. Adams said that that was an inappropriate choice. If that was an inappropriate choice, Dr. Danes, who's the head of allergy and immunology at the University of Arizona, who reviewed my charts every 2 weeks at the CPA Center, I'm sure would have told me if that was an inappropriate choice. So I, under the circumstance, that was good. Motrin is very safe. As far as the steroids go, in this case, as we've discussed, the steroids actually don't decrease immunity in the sense of making it problematic. What they actually do is they bring the immunity down back to a normal level. So there, it's like it's an asthma situation. Like you have asthma, we bring down with the steroid, very similar concept. And in fact, COVID in these types of situations tends to increase immunity, and we need to decrease it a little bit. So a 5-day pulse course of steroids is unbelievably safe. And quite frankly, it's the gold standard that we have in the initial phases of the disease process to ascertain if the child actually does have this diagnosis. If they do not, as you've seen in my supplemental report, as well as from Dr. Bozell, if they don't respond to steroids, it's exceedingly unlikely that these children actually have this diagnosis.
I want to ask one question. Let's talk about the conversation between you and her mother. This seems like this was the genesis of the complaint for the most part. And so I want to know what happened in your mind, because the patient's statement says that you were, I would say, just a little bit inappropriate.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I've read that complaint over and over and again. Allie Winsky, who was my medical student that was in there with me, when I asked her about that, I had her write did you notice anything about my demeanor? Did you notice anything? And she said no. But I think that the job of a physician, as a doctor, and this is for the medical students as much as anybody, is you have to figure out how to read a room. And I obviously didn't read this room right. That's the crux of the situation while I'm sitting here in front of you. I obviously could have done this better because we're sitting here. And at the end of the day, what I would have liked to do is when I would have seen that she was so resistant to the steroid, even though I thought it was important, instead of trying to convince her of that at that point, and is to bring her back in 5 days. And I actually did relent to that. If you see it on my documentation, I didn't actually write for the steroid. And I think I saw her on a Tuesday, and I called her, was going to try to call her on a Thursday to see how she was doing. And she, I have it here. She said, you know, thank you for your time, but you know, I'm not going to give the steroid. I'm going to seek other things. So I was disappointed that I didn't get to talk to her about that. She was visibly anxious. She was visibly distraught with her child's prognosis. I probably didn't pick up on that like I should have. I liken it back to when we told a kid that her son had type 1 diabetes, and the kid had come in for constipation, you know, and I did the whole spiel, your kid's going to go to Phoenix Children's, and the last thing she asked me is, well, what are we going to do about our constipation? I think I misidentified that this lady was overwhelmed. I think I gave her too much information. And once I saw her dig in her heels instead of trying to convince her, I missed that she wasn't going to do it. So at that point, you just back off, because it would have been at that. I mean, like, I feel terrible for this kid. I mean, if this kid really has it, it makes me sick to my stomach. What I'd like to do is back it up and just say, if we would have just said, hey, let's do the, I don't want to do the steroids now. And you kind of push a little bit, and then she doesn't. And I'd say, hey, let's do the Augmentin and let's do the Motrin. I think she would have done it. I would have seen her 5 days later, and this kid would have got appropriate treatment. And that's the thing that bothers me the most, is that I don't know if this kid got any help. And so no matter how I said it or how I did it, it still was a failure on my part to get this kid help. And, you know, that's going to, if the kid really does have PANDAS, that's bad. That haunts me.
In her letter, you also made accusations that she had a psychiatric disorder and that she herself should go see a psychiatrist. Do you think that was appropriate?
I did. That was a misunderstanding, that I can tell you. What we do from the Steele Center is, part of the Steele Center's diagnostic criteria is we get not only counseling for the child, but we also get counseling for the families as well. Pediatrics is unique in the sense that our job, especially as mandatory, we have to have difficult conversations. We have to ask parents how they're doing. I had a mother two months ago that had her seizure medication changed, and I thought she was drunk. That mom couldn't drive her children home. So we're in a unique situation. I would never say it that way. If I said it, it would be in the sense that there was a history of anxiety in the mother. There was history of schizophrenia in the biological father. Part of our treatment protocol is to treat these children and their families, because every mother, if they see their kid go from zero to OCD overnight, every mother absolutely has an issue with it. I always liken it to an aircraft carrier, how I try to explain it to people. If you think of a jet as the kid's brain, and you're in the middle of a typhoon, and it's going to, the aircraft carrier is going here, the first thing is you've got Motrin. Next is antibiotic. And the next cable is, you know, your steroid. And then the last cable that I use with Dr. Casper is an IVIG. And then after you get that plane on the deck, then you kind of do the debriefing, okay? I shouldn't have done the debriefing right then. I had the plane on the deck. The mom was on board. If I would have just done the antibiotics, I didn't need to go to the debriefing of, you probably, you know, you need some help as well. I should have waited for the following week to do that.
Yeah, I would say that probably wasn't smart to say that, because then automatically the radar goes up, and then you piss people off, and that's just not what you should be doing as a physician. I'm going to open the tables to the board members. So if you have some additional questions or concerns, I'd like to hear them.
May I, Dr. Erbstrasser?
Yes, sir, Dr. Madum.
Just to be clear, Dr. Sickerman, we're treating PANDAS, not PANDAS. This is not streptococcal diagnosis, correct?
And it's the problem of it is, it goes going back to Dr. Adams is correct in saying there's some gray area in here. If the child had it in the sinuses, as far as strep goes, and she wasn't making autoantibodies against it. Okay. And you could, if you did a nasal lavage and you identified strep pathogen in there, you could argue that it was PANDAS. If it was, if you didn't identify that organism in there, then it would be a secondary inflammatory situation, which would be a PANS. So, but they are treated the same way.
No, that's not a question. I understand. Thank you. But your presumption was a staphylococcal infection, not a streptococcal infection that you were treating in the sinuses?
Excellent question. I use staph as an example because people understand it. So when she heard that, she misunderstood that I was saying that. I said there's other causative organisms. If you have a staph infection, if the nose, if you have influenza, if you have any sort of inflammatory process that's causing problem, COVID, for example. She took that out of context, unfortunately, because that's obviously augmentin is not the what I typically would use for a staph infection.
Understand. Thank you very much, Dr. Speakerman.
Yes,
and just to the rest of the board, thank you. To the rest of the board, basically we have two major components to this. One is the treatment of a neuropsychiatric inflammatory response, whichever one we're going to diagnose this with. And the other is an interaction with the patient, or in this case, with the family member. So as far as if we fall below the standard of care, we have two branches to consider. Honestly, on the first branch, the treatment of this neuropsychiatric syndrome or disorder, there's a lot of gray zone and controversy, including the use of antibiotics. Honestly, I don't have a problem with you using augmentin, Dr. Speakerman, nor do I have a problem with your use of steroids. I think both are controversial and probably reasonably acceptable, or generally acceptable, if I can use that term. I don't think we're here to make final dispositions on what's controversial in the medical literature or not there. So I think that's a different subject. But item one, I don't think you fell below the standard of care. And the next question to the board is if they feel the interaction with the patient and or family member was below the standard of care. So if anybody has any questions on those matters, that's what I'd like to hear. And that's all I have, Mr. President.
All right, board members. I think, you know, the relationship between doctor and patient should be protected. What I mean by that is having those interactions as the way she described automatically just shut her brain off from you.
Mm-hmm.
It just did. And, you know, you can't get in their face. You can't tell them that you're the expert of experts. Okay, she was there for a second opinion. That's what she was there for. And, you know, I'm probably leaning to a letter of medical concern as it relates to that part of the equation.
Dr. Urshasha, can I mention something? I actually took it seriously enough that I took two courses of CME from the CDC in evaluating difficult cases because I felt it was one of those deals where, you know, you can always learn something more in order to help the families. And the way you're describing the way I talked with my tone or being aggressive, I think it was more – I respectfully – disagree with that. I would say if it was anything, it was more desperation than it was anything else. When you have a child like this, and you can't imagine what it's like to see one of these children that you don't treat, that you didn't get. You know, I don't know if you were able to get it in, but I have a letter here from, you know, Dr. Casper that this kid was. He went to Children's Hospital and was admitted and then was in Thunderbird and was admitted. And I sent him for a second opinion to Dr. Casper. And the kid's now normal. I mean, he's got a little residual OCD, but he was sniffing his armpit 30 times an hour. You know, so if my tone or if I sounded a little off, I was just doing what I thought was best for the patient. And to have somebody that I've spent my life, you know, I'm surprised I haven't been on front of the board sooner, but I've spent my life and then had the backing of the Steele Center to be able to do this. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing I would say to you and the board members and everybody, the medical students, is if it's as bad as cancer, yeah, I probably maybe was a little bit, if I was over the top, I'm sorry, I do apologize for that. And I always like the last physician that said, I would like to publicly apologize. I hope she reads this because, you know, at the, if you want to, if there's anything that you'd want to get me for, and I would happily take this, is that I was not able to convey in a way that I needed to do on a disease that I had spent my life's work and a lot of risk and a lot of passion and a lot of fear. And when nobody else would help these kids. And I finally had a kid that I thought within 4 to 6 weeks, I could actually stop this process and keep her from literally losing brain function and help that family's life. And the thing that, if you want to reprimand me for anything, that little, you can reprimand me for that. I didn't help that little girl. And that still, if she really did have it, I'm sorry.
Dr. Erbstrasser, can I make a motion to move to executive session for legal advice?
1 second.
Sorry, guys.
That's okay, Dr. Speakerman.
Sorry. 1 second in. All in favor say aye.
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 Just 1 moment.
We are in back in open session from executive session. My discussion, I just think there was an interaction issue with the patient's mom. So I'm going to recommend a non-disciplinary letter as it relates to poor patient communication and interaction with the patient's surrogate, which would be her mother. Does anybody have any other recommendations or would like to tap on non-disciplinary CME?
If I may.
Dr. Oda?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'd like to make a motion to require some continuing education on emotional intelligence training or patient communication and or professional and ethical boundaries in communication.
Is there a number of hours attached to that you'd recommend, Dr. Oda?
I believe 10 hours is an appropriate requirement.
And just a
time frame.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, a time frame. Would 6 months be appropriate?
6 months is fairly standard for
I think so.
And may this be completed either virtually or in person?
I think virtually should suffice, either or.
Good.
So I believe that Dr. Erbstrasser had made a motion for a non-disciplinary letter of concern relating to patient communications. Dr. Erbstrasser, would you accept Dr. Oda's suggestion as a friendly amendment?
Yes, that would be a nice amendment, please.
And then, Dr. Oda, is that your intention to second that?
Yes, okay. I second Dr. Erbstrasser's motion.
With the amendment?
With the amendment, yes.
And just a point of clarification, I'm sorry, is it the patient's mother or stepmother? What was the relationship? I'm sorry, your silence, Dr. Speakerman.
Is that right, Dr. Speakerman?
Yes, it was the patient's mother.
Mother, okay, thank you very much. I heard stepmother at some point, I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
That was her, yes, there, her stepmother was there as well.
Oh, good, thank you. That's where I got lost. Thank you very much.
All right, we have the motion on the floor. And we have a second to the amendment. Do we need a roll call vote, Mr. Bohol?
For non-discipline, no. But
all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
All right, Dr. Speakerman. Two recusals, if we could note that for the record.
Say again?
The two recusals, if we could note that for the record.
Oh, yes. And we have a recusal from Dr. Chapam and Mr. Berg.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, question. Is the two CMEs that I already did on patient interaction from the CDC, would that count towards the 10 hours?
No, I do not believe so. Okay. Dr. Oda was looking at a different form of CE, if I understood you correctly, Dr. Oda.
Yes.
Is there, Dr. Oda, is there a specific site that I can go to? I mean, I guess I've never heard of that, but is there a specific site I could go to get those areas? Are you familiar with, or could the board provide me with things that would be appropriate that I'd be happy to do?
Mr. Bohol can.
Thank you, Mr. Bohol. If you could get those in touch with me, I'll be more than happy to do that. I apologize for being in front of you. I thank you, gentlemen, for your time, and I'm looking forward to the CME.
Great. And Ms. Stedman, do you have any comments? Thank you for showing up, by the way.
Thank you. No, nothing at this time.
Okay. Thank all right. You're free to go, Dr. Speakerman. Have a good day.
Yep. Bye.
Thank you.
All right. Can we bring back in Mr. Berg and Dr. Chapin?
D.C., which is Tyler Pretzloff. I believe Dr. Pretzloff is present, and Mr. Von Zombie will provide the summary for the case.
Good morning, everybody.
Thank you.
This is a review and consideration for applications and licensure. This is 7CDO-22-0075A. Dr. Tyler, I hope I say this, Pretzloff?
Pretzloff, yes. Like Pretzloff is the easiest way to go about it.
Okay. All right. Mr. Zombie, Mr. Von Zombie.
Okay, so what we have here is an application by Dr. Pretzloff. Dr. Pretzloff is an osteopathic physician who seeks Arizona licensing and meets the state educational requirements. Dr. Pretzloff graduated from Midwestern University, Arizona, College of Osteopathic Medicine in Glendale, Arizona on 5/29/2019 and specializes in internal medicine. Dr. Pretzloff initially answered no on his application, but 2 months later changed his answer to yes to a question number one in section nine. Prior to the doctor's career as a licensed physician, Dr. Pretzloff was arrested on June 25th, 2011 and later charged for possession of marijuana, for which he paid a fine of $231.60, but he completed an 8-hour drug education program to satisfy the court and the charges were dismissed. However, there was an additional concern presented by the AZDO staff. Dr. Pretzloff applied for a postgraduate training permit in June of 2019. Dr. Pretzloff answered no to the question regarding past arrest, failing to disclose his June 25, 2011 arrest in Scottsdale, Arizona. This permit was granted based on the information the doctor provided because no background check is required for the postgraduate training permits. The permit did expire on June 30th, 2022. So the primary issue we have here is failure to disclose. Well, there's two of them. One is failure to disclose, and the other one is procuring, renewing, or attempting to procure renew a license to practice osteopathic medicine by fraud or misrepresentation, and that's under ARS 32-1854-9.
Bob, would you like to comment on our concerns?
Yes, absolutely. I do want to apologize to the board for failure to disclose this information. I do thank you for your time and consideration today. I do see how this has come off as an attempt to conceal information. In all truthfulness, though, it was mostly a misunderstanding on my part. Just based on how the court case ended up playing out, it was under my impression that I did not have to disclose this information moving forward. This was based on conversations I had with my lawyer at the time. It was just an oversight on my part that I really had to disclose this. Looking over the language in the application again, looks like, it probably was misinterpreted by me. Regardless of the outcome of the case, it should have been disclosed, and I understand that now. It's not in my nature to be deceitful. I really do take pride in my professionalism. I don't feel that, this incident or, what seemingly looks like I've been covering something up is in my nature. Or who I am as a person. During my residency, I never had any disciplinary action, no adverse actions against me. I really believe if you were to ask my colleagues and my mentors that professionalism is really my strong suit. So, I regret if this incident has put that into question. I truly apologize for the misunderstanding and not disclosing this information. But I do want to be completely transparent. I'm more than happy to answer any other questions you guys may have, give you any documents that I may have, as well as my lawyer's documents. I just want to be transparent with you at this time.
Questions for the board?
Dr. Strasser. So Dr. Pritzloff, I think he summarized it very well by saying it's mostly a misunderstanding. And, I mean, you're correct. It is easy to have a misunderstanding without having that charge change from what it was down to no current vehicle registration is a little bit confusing. However, that being said, you you did CE, and there was the initial charge of the paraphernalia, so that's still something that you were aware of. You did, however, seek legal advice on the other side of things, and that is what your lawyer recommended. So I think the short story is, if there's a question, call the board and ask. And Mr. Bullhole loves phone calls, and he'll answer them all day long, because that is very confusing. Because if the board finds something and you were not transparent enough to bring that forward, then that creates a potential problem. So sorry you're in front of us to have this discussion. Just a note to all of us, try to be as thoughtful about the application as possible. It's easy to check a yes or a no and just to sign at the end. That is something we're all responsible for doing correctly, even if somebody else recommends against reporting it. Again, that being said, use the correct person to ask. You asked your employer. So thank you for that. So sorry about that long discussion. I would like to make a motion to grant an unrestricted license.
Motion on the floor. Do we have a second? Dr. Oda? Second?
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? None. Motion passes. Welcome to Arizona and your licensure. Keep up the good work. Remember, fill out the application like you're supposed to.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm a lifelong Arizona resident, so I'm glad to be here and look forward to being here in the future. So thank you guys so much, and sorry for the confusion.
We have gotten a hold of Dr. Lyons, who will be joining shortly. But I believe Dr. DeMoss is available, and so I'll have you move to his case. Thank you, I see Dr. DeMoss. And Ms. Castro will provide this report.
Oh, was this? I read your note. Was it item A or is it still?
This is 7D, Jeffrey DeMoss. This was added after Wednesday's meeting.
7DDO-20-0050A, Dr. Jeffrey DeMoss, DO. Okay. Summary, please.
Dr. DeMoss was issued a license to practice osteopathic medicine in Arizona on January 18th of 1995. The license expired in May of 2008 for failure to renew. Dr. DeMoss has reapplied for licensure and his application is complete. On the application, Dr. DeMoss disclosed the disciplinary actions taken against his license by the Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs on August 29th of 2018. Dr. DeMoss stated his license was placed on probation and he was fined $5,250 for noncompliance with the continuing education requirements for license renewal. Staff received documentation from the state of Michigan stating that Dr. DeMoss completed the terms of the probation, and the probation was lifted February 22nd of 2019. Dr. DeMoss also holds a license in the state of Nevada, issued March 12th of 2019, and has no disciplinary action.
Dr. DeMoss, would you like to comment on the summary?
Yes. So I was practicing in Michigan for a couple of decades. And my dear spouse came down with psoriatic arthritis, and I realized I was going to have to move to the desert. So in the process of closing down my practice and looking for a job out in Arizona or Nevada or someplace, I got a quick look by the state of Michigan at my CMEs, and turned out I was behind. So I had to go back and get caught up on that, which I did, and you can see the paperwork there. But I got fined for that. And it couldn't have come at a worse time because it was right in the middle of interviewing for jobs and trying to get a license for the state of Nevada. And as you guys are aware, it doesn't look too good on your resume. Anyway, I got it all cleared up, paid the fine, went on with my life, got my license, and I'm now currently practicing in Las Vegas. And I like to keep my options open, and I'm looking around possibly, you know, not yet, but you never know, at maybe looking in Arizona. And so that's where we are now. So if you have any questions, let me know.
Members? No? So we're looking at full licensure, and the idea was he had CME allegations, and that was rectified. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And was there a failure to put that information on the application?
No, just that the disciplinary action did occur in Michigan. It has been resolved, so we didn't want to approve the application without the board having a chance to review it if they had any concerns or comments at this time.
Dr. DeMoss, what kind of physician are you?
So I'm board certified in family practice, although I'm currently doing geriatrics here in Las Vegas.
Dr. Madem, you had a question?
No. Motion to provide with an unrestricted license.
Second.
I'll second, Dr. Walker.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Welcome to Arizona. Hopefully you'll get here sometime.
Thank you.
I believe we have Dr. Lyons present. I understand that you were traveling, but you are pulled to the side of the road, so you are safe. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Okay, this is item.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Perfect. Okay, great.
Thank you,
Dr. Lyons. Item 7A, DO-22-0049A, Dr. Maurice Lyons. Can we have a review of the application, please?
Yes, this will be Dr. Prah.
Dr. Lyons is a board certified in vascular surgery, cardiac surgery, and general surgery. He currently holds licenses in Colorado and Wyoming. There was a malpractice case that occurred in 2015 and settled in 2016. This case involved an aortofemoral bypass graft performed on a 50-year-old male patient in May of 2015. 1 week after the procedure, the patient complained of abdominal pain, and a CT scan revealed a retained surgical towel. The patient underwent an additional surgery to remove the retained foreign body. There was a malpractice case that settled in 2016. He was disciplined by the state of Colorado in 2017 with a letter of admonition with regard to this malpractice claim. And that's it.
May I, Dr. Erbstrasser?
Yes, Dr. Maida.
Dr. Lyons, although obviously we take malpractice or problem seriously. Sounds like you've had a good career. This case was in 2015. And your letter of explanation answered every question I could possibly ask, so I would like to make a motion to grant an unrestricted license in Arizona.
Thank you, Dr. Madem. We have a motion on the floor. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Con, thank you. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Thanks, guys. The story here is I work for Banner. Obviously, Banner's big in Arizona. There are no heart surgeons left in the country right now, and there's two hospitals that are completely under covered. So the hospital's asked me to try and go down there and cover some vacations for the guys, Thunderbird and Boswell. And I'm also covering vascular up in Wyoming because there's no vascular surgeons either. So my license there would be just basically to go down and help out the guys that are down there because they're just getting creamed. That's it.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Lyons. Good luck.
God bless. Thanks. Have a good day. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Wait, I'm sorry. We're concerned that there wasn't a vote. Would you mind revoting?
All in favor? I think I did. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Okay.
Thank you. Just to cover for the record. Thank you.
Have a good day, guys.
Thanks.
All right.
That concludes the applications. 7B, applicant Woodall, withdrew her application. If you'd like to move to 8A, Dr. Ray.
Thank you. Moving to item 8A, DO-21-0167A, Dr. Jeremy Ray.
Yeah. And I can provide the summary on...
That would be great.
So, what my notes. I don't believe Dr. Ray or his attorney are present. On November 17th, 2021, board staff received notification from the respondent's attorney that the respondent was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct, criminal damage, and two charges that would be considered a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude. Respondent notified the board within 10 days as required by ARS 32-3208. Over the course of the investigation, the respondent pled guilty with a deferred prosecution to two charges. The two charges involving moral turpitude were dropped, and the remaining two will be dropped if he complies with the deferred prosecution. The deferred sentence is for 6 months. The respondent is required to obey all laws, successfully complete counseling, and pay a fee of $600. As I said, if he completes the terms of the deferred prosecution, the criminal charge of damage will be dismissed. The term of deferred prosecution ends October 15th, 2022. The respondent's attorney has requested that we resolve this through a non-disciplinary consent agreement for a letter of concern to acknowledge that the respondent was arrested but did properly report, and we'll have this matter resolved. The consent agreement also addresses if he fails to comply with the deferred prosecution, that the board can take further action. So that's why we're putting before you the non-disciplinary consent agreement for a letter of concern.
Motion. Does anybody have any questions regarding this? I think they've done a great job. Hold on.
Agreed.
The consent agreement and all of that.
Okay.
So I make a motion for non-disciplinary action with a letter of concern.
Is that signed by the...
I'm sorry, say that again, Dr. Madam?
You're saying, but we need as outlined by the consent agreement in there with the letter.
That is correct. Yeah. Outlined in the consent agreement.
Thank you.
Second. Do we have to say anything about the 6 months?
No, that's addressed in the consent agreement.
All right. Let's just have a regular vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes. Thank you very much for all your hard work.
Thank you. All right.
Does anybody need to go to the restroom or take a break? Because we can keep going. What's that?
No.
Soldier keep going?
Doing it.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to...
What we'll do is we'll invite the medical students to join us while we move on to item 10, because this can be a short discussion. One of the things that Dr. Madam and I took away from the Federation of State Medical Boards meeting in April and early May was establishing a medical malpractice policy to determine review. Ms. Galvin provided some excellent legal advice and interpretation of the statutes. I did email that all out to you to make sure that you had a chance to review it. To summarize, ultimately... and Gene, I don't want to, if you want to comment on it, I appreciate it. But it was based on her recommendation that it's not consistent with statute to establish that type of policy, and that it would be inadvisable to do so, but wanted to make sure I brought that to your attention. If anybody has any questions.
So, this is about setting this ceiling, is that correct?
Yes, and based on Gene's advice, is that you could not determine a threshold in which to investigate it because statute required that board staff investigate all malpractice complaints and for any determination of unprofessional conduct. And by setting that threshold, you would be not investigating complaints for unprofessional conduct. There's no need to take a vote, but I just wanted to make sure that I had brought that to your attention and addressed it.
I appreciate the discussion and that letter you sent there. Thank you very much. Email, I should say, but thank you very much.
Good. Okay. Let's move on to the medical students.
Okay. I believe we have some medical students joining. If you'd like to turn on your cameras, we're eager to begin a conversation with you. Thank you so much for joining.
Welcome. Is everybody on camera now? So it's good to have you. Let's get started just with, we can't discuss the major details. This is rather a very short board meeting. So do you have any concerns or questions or input? Somebody speak up.
You guys don't ask questions. We ask you questions.
Yeah. Make sure everybody gets on. So I'll ask them questions. They can tell me what they think. Mm-hmm. So true or false, you have to be absolutely truthful on your application regarding the circumstances. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. Tell me what they think. It can come back. Yeah, I just have to do it. Dr. Maiden, do you have any comments?
Well, they didn't ask any questions, so we have to ask them some questions. Okay. Why don't we start with, let's see, how about Justin over there? Justin, do you think that training to be a physician is an easy process and is conducive to the mental health of the individual?
Definitely not an easy process. I would say there have been strides made recently to kind of improve it, but I think we still have a little ways to go as far as, I think you said being conducive to the individual, but I think we're working on it. And like, even our, like at AT Still, they've made a few different changes this year. And like having the DSMEs, I feel like we know our, like DSMEs really well. And better than they have in years past, and I feel like I can talk to them. So that's a good start.
Good. And how about other no, I appreciate that. That's very good, Justin. And how about other Justin? Out required CE to a physician? Not that we're talking about an individual case, but did you hear a discussion about individual required CE?
I think in this case it's definitely warranted. Again, not in in the context of a particular case we heard this morning, but obviously if a physician ends up being put in front of the board.
Yeah, what was the CE about, though, that we were talking about?
I apologize. Can you repeat that?
What was the continuing education that we were talking about at that time?
We were talking about emotional communication and interpersonal communication with patients' family members.
Right. And we've talked about this as a board amongst ourselves before. Dr. Oda, could you tell the students a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's I think he was a sociologist. He wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence. And interestingly, this book, it was introduced to me when I used to work for an HMO practice. And the way that I even came about this was, I remember one time I had an interaction with another staff member, and I got a call from my supervisor saying, "Hey, man, you know, there's this really cool course that all physicians really should take." And it was kind of a local thing where, and the whole thing was just role playing. It was role playing on how to communicate high stakes ideas, or how to handle, high stakes situations, things that can be very emotionally charged. And that kind of spearheaded me into just this topic of emotional intelligence, professional communications. How is it that we talk to the people that we care about in our lives, family, patients, that are very vulnerable, right? They don't necessarily know how to cope with the things that they're feeling, whether it's anxiety, loss of family, or just a very charged emotion about whatever is going on in their life. And, you know, we're in a position in our practices where we have a lot of authority. And so we have really the control of how it is that we dictate how that encounter goes. And the more controlled, calm we are, the more we can actually, almost as a form of therapy to our patients, control and calm their emotions down based on whatever it is that they're feeling. So I think it's just one of those things where in medicine, yeah, we are held to a very high standard to have medical knowledge. Obviously, it's very important. But there's another skill set that we really need to, I think, over the course of our careers, over the course of our lives, continually work on, and that is emotional intelligence. So I think if anything, when you come out of school, when you get into residency, and even throughout your practice, there should just sort of be this continual check-in with how it is that you're interacting with not only the patients that you take care of, the staff that you work with, and all the interdisciplinary team that you work with, and of course, most importantly, with the loved ones in your life.
I appreciate that. Yeah, there are great books on emotional intelligence, but also on compassion. And it's not just about communication, although that's essential, but it's also about your understanding, your empathy for your patient and or family in some cases. I mean, it can definitely help you communicate, because most of what we do is communication, right? It's only a small percentage of the time you're saving somebody's life by putting a finger on an artery. Most of what we do is passing on information and convincing somebody to do what we're saying. If we tell somebody to take a blood pressure medicine, but they don't believe us, then they're less likely to take the blood pressure medicine. And being able to understand the perspective of the patient, what they're thinking, will make it more likely you'll be able to communicate effectively. Not only that, but we get into this in great deal. You hear about burnout being one of the most common topics. Is our compassion, although that can surely make us feel more for the patient, which has the disadvantage of sometimes we have too much emotion. You'll have a bad case that'll affect you greatly, like you heard mentioned earlier today. These things can wear on you, but your compassion is not necessarily something that has to be a liability. It can make you more efficient and help you keep yourself engaged in your job. If you're engaged in your job, you're less likely to make unnecessary mistakes because we're all human. You saw somebody miss an obvious finding there because they were distracted. That's the kind of thing that can cost a life. In that case, luckily it didn't, but it can. So make sure you communicate with your patients like human beings, like equals. And you also take care of yourselves. Don't overstress or overstrain your emotions, but make sure you still have adequate feelings that you can do your job in the way we're supposed to. Thank you, Dr. Herbstrasser.
Thank you, Dr. Maiden, Dr. Oda. We didn't see the case today. Usually we have one almost every board meeting, but drugs and alcohol physicians. And I'm going to kind of lean on Dr. Prah to discuss some of the do's and don'ts and what programs are available when you do have a problem.
Thank you, Dr. Herbstrasser. Yes, we had obviously a very short meeting today. Usually it lasts much longer than this, but and usually we do have at least one or two cases in which a physician either is over-prescribing or possibly has some difficulty with drug and alcohol use themselves. Sometimes it's, you know, something that needed to be reported on an application, and sometimes there's been patient harm because of it. We, you know, obviously the board takes all of these kinds of things very seriously. And our, you know, our mission is to protect the public. And one of the ways we can protect the public is to make sure that physicians in Arizona are healthy and practicing at their optimum level by making sure that they're not suffering from any kind of drug or alcohol addiction. We have a program in Arizona, and the MD, our MD counterparts have the same program. It is called the Confidential Physicians Program, and it's set up so that anyone can self-report or report another physician to us that they that either you feel, the physician feels that they have a problem or someone else feels that they may have a problem. And with this program, it allows us to help the physician to get the appropriate, you know, have an evaluation and then get the appropriate care that they need to become sober and to treat their addiction. If there's been no patient harm and there's been no serious legal activity regarding this, you're allowed, the physician is allowed to enter the confidential program. And the program may last, you know, any number of years depending on what the evaluator determines. It allows the person to be monitored for the period of time and receive counseling or whatever is necessary. It's a very, you know, it's a wonderful program because in the past, many, many, many years ago, this wasn't available, and anyone that ever had a, I mean, we're all human, you know, and we are subject to the same difficulties that the rest of the population is subject to. And the physicians in the past, it was just automatically put on their record, and it caused them great difficulties. Now, you know, people can get sober, and they have this opportunity. You know, the only way that a physician wouldn't be able to enter the program is if they absolutely are not willing to follow the instructions of the evaluator. Or if, you know, there's some reason that they're not able to enter, like patient harm or legal issues. But it's been a great program for many people. And one of the things that we always talk about is that while you're in medical school, yes, you are very busy, and it's very stressful. So it feels like it would not be a great time to take time out to get, you know, to have this treatment. But if there's really no better time than the present. So if you know someone that might be suffering from this, or if you are, we encourage you to contact us, and we will help people with this addiction problem. Also, the other thing that we always talk about that usually we have is a DUI. A DUI sometimes can be sort of a red flag that there could be a bigger problem with the person. And sometimes it's simply a mistake. I mean, you cannot believe how many people we have that come before us that were celebrating because they graduated medical school and they, drank too heavily, or celebrated because they finished their residency. They drank too heavily and they made the mistake of driving. It really affects your life forever. It stays on your record forever. So if, you know, one of the things that we talk about is if you decide that you are going to drink, even one drink, it's really important that you know you have a safe ride home, whether it's a ride share or whether you have a designated driver. So that's our advice. And if you have any questions or concerns, I'm available at any time.
Thank you, Dr. Prah. Always well said. Any other input from board members?
Questions from the medical students? Mr. President, actually, we do have a student who has a question, Dr. Blankenmaker, if you'd like to go ahead and respond.
Mr. President and fellow board members, first of all, thank you for having us here today. We really appreciate the opportunity. My question was kind of pertaining to, we saw a couple cases today where we had non-disciplinary actions taken. What's kind of like the defining boundary between when you guys opt for non-disciplinary action versus disciplinary action on a specific physician's case?
Could I answer that one, Dr. Erbstrasser?
Would you like to?
Yes. I would, and Gene and Mr. Bohol might have some more information. And a lot of times, and I apologize, in the one case I actually didn't go into it, but a lot of times we'll take the time that we're making a motion to actually say, this is my concern, however the reason it is or is not disciplinary. In one case, I did not. So keep in mind the basis of our job is to protect the public. So in a case, so sorry, I do have to get that. Dr. Erbstrasser, do you mind taking over?
Sure. Sure, I'll do it. Not sure that I do mind. So non-disciplinary action, we have certain rules and punishment, if you want to call it that, for what we do to help physicians move forward. And Ms. Galvin is our lead attorney, and I would like to have her comment. Because she, every time we go into executive session, we talk about what are we going to do? That's all. We can't discuss the case. We're frequently reminded that that it's purely there for legal advice. And so I'm going to have Ms. Galvin comment.
Good morning. So what typically defines when the board is going to resolve a case with disciplinary action or non-disciplinary action is whether there's a violation of statute or rule. They have two ways that they can resolve a matter with non-disciplinary action, and that's a letter of concern that basically tells the licensee that your conduct did not rise to the level of a statutory or regulatory violation, but nonetheless, the board expressed concern that, you know, name it, maybe your communication with patients was poor, your record keeping is, you know, on the verge of not making it to the standard of practice. So you just need to be careful going forward that you pay more attention in this particular area. A non-disciplinary order for continuing education is also another way that the board can resolve matters where they don't think that there is a violation, but nonetheless, they think that there's room for improvement in the physician's conduct. So as you heard, they issued one of those orders today. They didn't think that there was a violation, you know, in the care, but yet they saw room where for improvement in a particular physician's conduct. Then when you go to the disciplinary action, that's where you have found that a violation has occurred. And any violation of statute or rule, perhaps there was negligence, anywhere where you could fall below the standard of care. And in those instances, it can range anywhere from a decree of censure up to disciplinary continuing education, an administrative warning, and then you could have probation with certain terms or the suspension or revocation of a license. So the board has a number of options available to it, and every case is treated differently. The facts of each case are very important, but I'm here to help, you know, guide the board. And if they need legal advice, then we can step out of the public domain, the public part of the meeting, and go into executive session where they can ask questions and then receive legal advice.
And, Mr. President, I have one thing to add. Something that I kind of talk about that we did when we discuss disciplinary actions. The intention of a disciplinary action is not to be punitive. It's not to, cause suffering or pain. The intention is to say, you're not meeting the standard of care. This is how we believe that you can come up to that standard and continue to be a productive member of the profession. So that's the intention behind, disciplinary action, is to get some corrective action imposed. It's only very serious when they have to suspend a license or revoke a license. And the board does not ever take that decision lightly. And so the board's trying to fix those issues before getting to a level of having to suspend or revoke.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Galvin and Mr. Bohol. That was really a nice summary.
And if I can jump in again, Dr. Erbstrasser, I apologize to get called out there. And you probably covered this. I know you partially covered it at least. Mr. Bohol was saying, this is not meant to be so much punitive, but to keep the public safe. That's our job, like Dr. Erbstrasser said in the beginning of the meeting, is the safety of the public as well as our educational standards. So sometimes the problem has been addressed and there's no reason for us to proceed further, as you probably heard in some of the cases, in which case there's no reason to be punitive. Sometimes something needs to be mentioned or said because there may or may not be a pattern of concern or was too much, and then obviously sometimes it does need to have something that's disciplinary. But thank you very much for jumping in there. My pardons for getting interrupted.
Board members, any other board members have any input? Any questions by the medical students? I think that was a really round-robin discussion. I think that was really, really good. usually we get kind of nobody wants to talk, but that was particularly the medical students. We got Mr. Blankbaker over there. Very much appreciated. So all in all, any, is there anything else, any other further discussion by board members or medical students? Okay. Well, you're free to go. Go hit the books because I'm sure that's where you're going. And you're welcome to go. It's nice to have you here. And I think it's such a great thing to have this experience. A lot of medical schools don't.
Please go. Enjoy the day.
Yep. Thank you all.
Thank you all again.
All right. If you'd like to turn to tab 11A, we can do report from board members. If any board members have something to report or discuss.
Nothing to report.
Okay. We want to move to 11B, Executive Director's Report. It is a short report today because I do not have the financial reports back from the Central Services Bureau. I do have to report that the legislature met. They have passed a budget very close to the end of the fiscal year. We were provided an appropriation. There was certain increases to our appropriation. They provided a 10% salary increase to all state employees, so we are a part of that, and we're grateful for it. And we were provided an additional employee that we are beginning the process of hiring to help with our investigations, because our investigations case load continues to increase, so we're trying to work and address that. As regarding complaints, we have 196 total pending cases. Ms. Galvin and our other attorney, Seth Hargraves, have been hard at work in front of OWA resolving some of the formal hearing cases. So we hope to have some more resolutions for the remaining cases here in the next couple of months. You dealt with 7 cases today on the agenda. We have 34 that we're in the process of scheduling and getting before you in the next couple of months, and that 105 that we're currently investigating and getting final final reports on. Let's see. Regards to licensing, I have some great news on licensing. We had 645 total applications last year. That's a 20% increase year over year. So we continue to have a growing number of licensees. We had our largest post-grad season ever. Ms. Maxwell and the licensing staff did a great job on processing those. We had 680 post-grad permits that were issued this year. Previous year was, I believe, 576, so nearly 100 new PTs. And the other big news regarding licensing, as of August 1st, our initial licensing application is now entirely online through a portal. So we no longer will receive paper applications. Everything's going to be online to make ease of access to the application process. So we are continuing to move forward to be a paperless office. The last item that I have for the report is the October 1st, 2022 is the next meeting. And then on the executive director's report for dismissed cases, we had 11 cases that were dismissed by the executive director in the last board meeting. And that takes care of my report if there's no questions.
First of all, Justin, that's very thorough.
Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate some of it. I understand. Sometimes I don't. I'm glad you guys got a raise, that's for sure.
Thank you.
Anything else for the board? Anybody has any questions? We're looking maybe at January for full in-house office meeting.
And I can and talk about that. So as you know, that we partnered with the medical board to upgrade Boardroom A to facilitate these Zoom and hybrid meetings going forward. Due to supply chain issues, we do not have microphones or cameras down in that room, and half the furniture arrived damaged. So we didn't feel that we could put on the spectacular show that we try to strive for in that environment. So we're hoping that they can get everything built and taken care of for January, because we're really anxious to have you guys come down. But you will have new desks and new equipment when you do come back.
That's great. Any other board members? Well, welcome, everybody. Thank you so much. And we'll see you, Justin and I, you and Dr. Madam and staff. We'll have our pre-board meeting whenever that is. And we'll do well.
Yep. So if you'd like to make the motion for adjournment.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. Me.
Dr. Walker, second.
Dr. Walker. Dr. Walker, okay. Guys, enjoy your gals. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll see you back here soon. Good luck next week. Okay.
Do we have a vote? I apologize.
Oh, all in favor, say aye.
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 Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.